First, let me say what a pleasure it is to welcome Anna Medjou back to the Maison Française at NYU, as well as Bruno Bastilles, who was a speaker here 2 years ago when we held a roundtable on the topic of Badiou's book, The Century. Before proceeding any further with brief introductions, I want to let the audience know that Anna will be speaking in French today. Though this was indicated by the French title on the poster and the flyer, it may not have been clear to you. So anyway, this will be a bilingual event, not because we'll be translating Badiou's talk in simultaneous translation, but because our two discussants, Martin Buchner and Bruno Bastilles, will be commenting in English afterwards. And we're happy to take questions after their discussion, either in English or in French. Today we thank the Maison Française, the Department of French, the Center for French Civilization and Culture, the Humanities Initiative, the NYU Council for Media and Culture, and the Department of Comparative Literature for making today's discussion possible. We've organized this session, as many of you know, around the forthcoming English publication of Badiou's Rhapsodie pour le théâtre, Cours traité philosophique, which came out in French in 1990. It will appear in Bruno Bastilles' translation, edited by Martin Buchner, in Theater Survey, number 42, Cambridge University Press. And I have written here any day now, but it exists, it's there. The fact that it is subtitled, A Short Philosophical Treatise, aligns this text with other works by Badiou. I'm thinking specifically of his Cours traité d'ontologie transitoire, Readings on Existence, A Short Treatise on Transitory Anthology, and Petit Manuel de l'Esthétique, The Handbook of Inesthetics, both published in 1998. Together, they point to the importance of the short tract in Badiou's oeuvre, the manifesto, the political prise de position, which many see as integral to an understanding of Badiou's more substantial works of philosophy, theory of the subject, being an event, and most recently, the metamorphous logics of worlds. Though one would not be wrong in thinking that Rhapsodie is a work about theater, it is about theater as a space of politics, a strange public space, as he says, in which, quote, fiction consumes itself as a repeatable event and where recriminations, excommunications, spiritual enthusiasms play themselves out under the surveillant eye of the state. Badiou recognizes in theater three similarly important constitutive elements. First, the specter of the public, the convocation of the masses in the waiting room of the event, which gives the lie to the assumption that institutions of rational choice exercise sole authority over the realm of the political. Second, the actors, who incarnate multiplicities of subject effects and introduce scission into the sphere of social unanimity. And third, the text passé, the coming into appearance of an idea or thought's entrance into discourse. These necessary components of politics are expounded in a text that is itself composed according to dramatic genres and gestures. There are proclamations of hate and love for the theater, snippets of mock platonic dialogue between a Badiou character, identified as moi, and his interlocutor, the empiricist, and even footnotes are marshaled for autocritique under the banner Note, référence, repentir. The entire text is an echo chamber of revolutionary cacophony and alienation effects, from the festivals of the French and Russian revolutions to the anti-theatrical dramaturgical experiments of Mallarmé, Sartre, René, Brecht, and Beckett. Part of my personal interest in having Alain, Martin, and Bruno address Badiou as a theorist of theater stems from my sense that as Badiou's philosophy is more ardently and universally engaged with worldwide, and his translations of his major works scream out, his output as both creative writer and literary critic deserves to be better known. What he writes about Mallarmé, Rimbaud, Brecht, and Beckett is genial. In fact, we need a collection in English of his writings about these figures if there isn't one already forthcoming. As for his work as novelist, poet, and playwright, few have engaged with it. I first came across his work, The Red Scarf, Les Chapes Rouges, a few years ago in a village bookstore, and I enjoyed it, labeled by Badiou a roman opéra, The elision between the words Beaumont and Opéra is suggestive of a new generic form. Published in 1979 by Maspero, weighing in at 255 pages and relying on hundreds of characters, the work is both unwieldy and exciting in much the same way as Peter Watkins' almost six-hour epic film La Commune. I later learned that the great director Antoine Vitez had staged and directed the play in 1984, proof that despite the daunting challenge it posed, it was in fact performable. As was Badiou's play, which I also really recommend, Ahmed Le Subtil, which he wrote in 1994 as part of a trilogy, and which showed off his flair for argot, inflected dialogue, and techniques of slapstick and farce. This play was performed in France in that year. In asking you to consider Badiou the playwright alongside Badiou the philosopher, the political theorist, the aesthetician, and the activist, my intention is not to erect Badiou as an avatar of interdisciplinarity and polymathic ability, nor to turn him into a character of multiple characters. Rather, I would simply like to emphasize that if we want to begin to grasp Badiou's novel conception of politics, particularly his idea of a communism to come, then we must understand the extent to which for Badiou, le théâtre est le grand mouvement figuratif de la politique, that theater, at least potentially, is the figural renewal and renovation of politics. Joining Alain Badiou to discuss his work are Martin Buchner and Bruno Bastilles. Martin is a professor of English and Comparative Literature at Columbia University, where he also directs the theater PhD program. He's the author of Stage Fright, Modernism, and Reality Drama, 2002, and Poetry of the Revolution, Marx, Manifestos, and the Avant-Gardes, which is a Princeton book of 2006, in my book series, and winner of the MLA's James Russell Lowell Award. He's currently the editor of Theater Survey and a general editor of several Norman anthologies. Bruno Bastilles is an associate professor of romance studies at Cornell and the translator, as I mentioned, of Rhapsodie pour le Théâtre. He's one of the foremost converts of Badiou's work and writing in the Anglophone world. In addition to translating a number of Badiou's books, and he just mentioned that Théorie du sujet, Theory of the Subject, will be coming out soon. He's also translated Can Politics Be Thought? And An Obscure Disaster on the End of the Truth of State and What Is That Kind of Philosophy? Essays on Nietzsche, Wittgenstein, and Lacan. He has himself a book on Badiou called Badiou and Politics that will be coming out with Duke, and he's the general editor of the Journal of Critics. So, with all of that, I'm going to now turn things over to Alain Badiou, who needs no further introduction. He'll speak for roughly 40, 45 minutes, and then Bruno and Martin will respond. Thank you.
Platon reproche au théâtre sa pratique du rôle, du masque, de l'imitation. Il y a au théâtre une sorte de polymorphie suspecte. Il y a un rôle du semblant. Et le théâtre éloigne de l'idée au lieu de rapprocher. Le théâtre montre le partage, l'hésitation, le retournement. Alors que le philosophe tente, lui, de remonter jusqu'au principe de ce qui est. On peut dire que pour Platon, la, La philosophie est solaire, tandis que le théâtre est nocturne. Le « ce qui est », l'être même, n'est pas, pour Platon, une catégorie du théâtre. Le théâtre s'intéresse au passage, à l'équivoque sexuel, au paradoxe mensonger du destin. Et le pire pour Platon, c'est que cette imitation capte le sujet, saisit le sujet, avec une violence beaucoup plus considérable que celle que la philosophie est capable de produire. On sent bien que chez Platon, il y a un désir contrarié de théâtre. Il y a la volonté d'être aussi puissant que le théâtre. Mais sans y arriver. Rousseau, lui, dans la lettre à D'Alembert sur les spectacles, critique sévèrement le théâtre, cette fois d'un point de vue moral et politique. Pour Platon, c'est la question de la connaissance. Pour Rousseau, c'est plutôt la question de l'action. Le spectacle, le théâtre, est représentation. Alors que l'essence du pouvoir politique légitime, de la démocratie, c'est la présentation du peuple comme volonté générale. Le théâtre, peut-on dire, corrompt la présentation par la représentation. Il capte le public à partir d'une sorte d'obscurité intransmissible, voire inavouable, et il est fondé sur le désir. Rousseau va opposer au théâtre la fête civique, le rassemblement des citoyens, qui est une sorte de présentation innocente du peuple à lui-même. Un rassemblement qui ne montre rien, qui se suffit à lui-même, qui est simplement la présentation de l'immanence du vouloir. Et l'exemple, le troisième exemple, l'allemand Nietzsche, c'est peut-être le plus curieux. De tout, Nietzsche est un terrible anti-platonicien, donc on pourrait imaginer qu'il va lui opposer le théâtre à l'abstraction philosophique. Mais non, il y a une haine du théâtre dans l'esthétique de Nietzsche. Déjà au début, dans l'origine de la tragédie, premier livre de Nietzsche, Nietzsche explique que ce qui a créé l'art grec, l'art dionysaque grec, ce n'est pas le théâtre, c'est la musique. La musique est la véritable origine de la tragédie. Et Nietzsche dénonce ensuite le devenir théâtral de la tragédie. Euripide, c'est précisément celui qui a transformé en théâtre ce qui était à l'origine musique dramatique. Dans les diatribes contre Wagner, à la fin de sa vie, l'accusation principale contre Wagner, c'est que Wagner a prostitué la musique au profit de l'effet théâtral. Le théâtre pour Nietzsche est fausse pensée, un simulacre plébéien, et il substitue à la volonté active et pensante une sorte de promesse floue qui finalement, n'a de valeur qu'en tant qu'elle est un sens hystérique de la scène. Le théâtre, c'est très important pour Nietzsche, est l'hystérie de l'art. Et le théâtre est une pensée d'avant la pensée, dit Nietzsche. Une pensée encore flou et incapable de s'affirmer, c'est une démagogie spirituelle qui s'oppose à la puissance de la vie. Au fond, le théâtre, c'est l'art nihiliste par excellence. L'art direct, l'art qui n'est pas nihiliste, l'art qui affirme la vie, l'art qui, je cite Nietzsche, donne un nouveau nom à la terre, c'est la danse. L'esthétique de Nietzsche repose sur une opposition fondamentale entre le théâtre et la danse. Zarathustra dira Nietzsche, que je cite, a des pieds de danseur enragé. Mais il est le théâtre. Le théâtre est l'opposé de la danse. Le théâtre est ce qui ruine la danse. Donc, avec Platon, un procès fait au théâtre sur le plan de connaissance. Avec Rousseau, un procès fait au théâtre sur le plan de la morale et de la politique. Et avec Nietzsche, un procès fait au théâtre sur le plan de l'art et de l'esthétique. Il y a aussi trois exemples tout aussi fameux de liaison positive entre le théâtre et la philosophie. Un grec, un français, un allemand. Aristote, Sartre et Brecht. Aristote, vous le savez, parce que pour Aristote, la tragédie a une fonction éthique positive. La tragédie permet de projeter dans l'imaginaire des passions néfastes. C'est la fameuse catharsis comme purification du spectateur des passions mortifères par leur représentation. C'est le mouvement exactement inverse de celui de Rousseau. Au fond, ce que dit Aristote, c'est que la représentation théâtrale, épure, protège la présentation subjective. La représentation n'est pas du tout une corruption, elle est une purification. Et donc le rapport entre présentation et représentation est inversé. Nous avons donc un éloge éthique de la tragédie chez Aristote. Pour Sartre, le théâtre, c'est le moyen le meilleur pour montrer l'absolu de la liberté. Le théâtre, c'est le lieu où l'on peut le mieux présenter ce que c'est qu'un choix. Toutes les pièces de Sartre sont le montage de situations complexes à l'intérieur desquelles le sujet, le personnage, va devoir renoncer à la liberté. Cette prononciation souveraine de la liberté sur la scène, c'est pour Sartre un élément extrêmement puissant au service, finalement, de la philosophie de la liberté. Le théâtre, au fond, c'est l'esthétique du choix absolu. C'est ce qui permet de représenter le choix absolu. Donc nous avons chez Sartre un éloge, qu'on peut dire, existentiel du théâtre. Le théâtre montre la vérité et la puissance de l'existence individuelle et collective. Et enfin Brecht, pour rappeler que Brecht est quelqu'un pour qui la philosophie matérialiste et dialectique était fondamentale. Le but de Brecht, son plus grand désir, était de créer ce qu'il appelait une société des amis de la dialectique. Et du reste, pour lui, le théâtre était un moyen au service de cette société des amis de la dialectique, dont il espérait, dont il pensait qu'elle pouvait devenir une pièce nouvelle, une pièce essentielle du nouveau monde. Et le théâtre, pour Brecht, était le lieu même de la dialectique. Tous les concepts de Brecht, les concepts théâtraux de Brecht, distanciation, séparation, monstration, tout cela est au service, en réalité, d'une présentation de la dialectique comme souveraine dans l'action et dans le destin politique. C'est bien qu'avec Aristote, nous avons un éloge éthique du théâtre, avec Sartre, un éloge existentiel, avec Brecht, un éloge philosophique. Alors, nous avons trois grands procès, trois grands éloges. On peut conclure que le rapport de la philosophie du théâtre est certainement ambigu, compliqué. D'autant plus compliqué qu'on pourrait très bien renverser les exemples et leur faire dire le contraire de ce qu'ils disent. On pourrait dire, par exemple, que pour Platon, la forme active de la philosophie, c'est le dialogue. En réalité, il n'y a pas de philosophie plus théâtrale dans son être même que Platon. Comme vous savez, les dialogues de Platon sont encore joués fréquemment aujourd'hui. Platon est au répertoire du théâtre, de beaucoup de théâtres dans le monde entier. On pourrait dire que donc, la philosophie, pour lui, c'est ce que j'appellerais le théâtre du maître. C'est la monstration, la représentation de l'activité du maître philosophe dans le rapport aux disciples, aux jeunes gens, à l'opinion, et qu'il n'y a pas, de ce point de vue, de philosophie qui soit plus liée dans sa conception même au théâtre. Alors que pour Aristote, la philosophie proprement dite, c'est le traité, c'est pas du tout le théâtre. Mais il y a une fable. Il y a une fable qui dit que Platon avait écrit des traités et qu'ils ont été perdus, et qu'Aristote avait écrit des dialogues et qu'ils ont été perdus. Enfin, c'est un hasard un peu énorme. Enfin, nous pouvons quand même lui donner une interprétation. Parce que pour Aristote, le fait est que la philosophie, elle n'est pas du tout dans le dialogue. Je dirais même qu'Aristote est l'inventeur du traité académique. Si l'on parlait le langage de Lacan, on dirait que Aristote est l'inventeur du discours de l'université. Et c'est la disposition philosophique d'Aristote, beaucoup moins théâtrale, beaucoup plus anonyme que celle de Platon. Premier renversement. Pour ce qui est Rousseau, il est tout de même coupable d'avoir écrit pour le théâtre, après l'avoir violemment condamné. Il a écrit des tentatives de pièces, il a écrit un opéra comique. C'est quelqu'un qui faisait souvent le contraire de ce qu'il disait. Mais surtout, c'est quelqu'un qui a le génie des grandes scènes théâtrales en liaison avec la pensée du sens de l'existence. De ce point de vue-là, La Nouvelle Héloïse, c'est un roman, c'est une affaire entendue, c'est un roman dans un lien extraordinairement étroit à la philosophie de Rousseau. Quelquefois, je pense même que c'est le plus grand livre de philosophie de Rousseau, précisément parce que tous les grands thèmes, la voix de la conscience, la sensibilité, l'amour, la fonction de la nature, l'utopie sociale, tout cela est présenté dans des scènes qui sont le plus souvent tout à fait dramatiques, qui sont des scènes tout à fait théâtrales à l'intérieur de la prose romanesque. Donc on peut dire ça pour Rousseau, tandis que pour Sartre, à l'inverse, comme pour Aristote d'ailleurs, la construction conceptuelle reste fondamentale. La présentation des choses au théâtre existe, mais on sent bien que derrière, il y a une construction abstraite, une construction conceptuelle, donnée dans de gros pavés théoriques, comme L'être et le néant, Critique de la raison dialectique, qui sont tous sauf théâtraux, qui sont dans une épaisseur conceptuelle et écrite à l'opposé de la dynamique théâtrale. Et pour Nietzsche, enfin, il faut tout de même remarquer qu'il assume finalement l'obscurité poétique de la prose philosophique Et que plus important encore, il assume le persona. C'est quelqu'un qui a véritablement créé sa philosophie en persona. Zarathustra, le crucifié, Dionysos, l'errant, etc. Il n'y a pas, si on veut donner sens à l'expression de Deleuze, personnage conceptuel, il n'y a pas plus créateur de personnage conceptuel que Nietzsche. C'est arrivé de dire qu'on pouvait résumer la philosophie de Nietzsche par la présentation de la constellation de ses personnages. Je crois que c'était ça. Et donc, en ce sens, il y a une théâtralité évidente de Nietzsche. Cependant, en revanche, pour Brecht, c'est évident que le théâtre a une fonction didactique. Chez Brecht, le personnage est un peu porté et en même temps dissous par la fonction d'explication dont il est le porteur conscient, le porteur voulu et délibéré. Donc finalement, non seulement on a des positions violentes contre le théâtre et des positions non moins violentes pour, mais finalement, si on regarde de près, ces positions se retournent aussi en leur contraire. C'est dire qu'il y a un mystère. Il y a un mystère de la relation du théâtre et de la philosophie. Disons qu'il y a une théâtralité de la philosophie, quand mon ami Bruno en dira un mot, qu'il estime que j'en suis un représentant, personnage, et puis il y a une didactique philosophique du théâtre. Les deux sont évidents. Les deux sont évidents. Donc on peut dire que le théâtre et la philosophie ont été inventées en même temps et en un certain sens sont inséparables. Alors, cette inséparabilité du théâtre et de la philosophie, je pense que pour la comprendre, il faut rapporter les deux en réalité à la religion. Je pense qu'il y a dans le théâtre comme dans la philosophie, un geste pour séparer la pensée de la religion. Les deux naissent dans l'élément de la religion. Quand on voit les premières tragédies d'Eschyle, ou quand on lit les présocratiques, on voit que dans le contenu comme dans le style, il y a encore une sorte de position religieuse au sens de la diction. Il y a quelque chose de prophétique, quelque chose qui annonce avec solennité les caractéristiques du vrai. Au fond, l'histoire du théâtre et l'histoire de la philosophie, c'est aussi l'histoire de leur séparation historique avec cette prononciation religieuse. Et ça, c'est leur destin commun. Alors on pourrait dire quelque chose comme ça. Le théâtre et la philosophie ont tenté de proposer, tentent encore aujourd'hui de proposer, ce que j'appellerais une vision profane du destin. Vision profane du destin. Le théâtre montre sur la scène les figures du sens de l'existence humaine. La philosophie en élabore les concepts, mais dans les deux cas, il s'agit d'un discours qui ne s'autorise que de lui-même. Il s'agit d'une parole qui vaut pour elle-même et par elle-même, et non parce qu'elle est garantie par un sujet d'énonciation. Ce n'est pas la parole du prêtre, ce n'est pas la parole du roi, ce n'est pas la parole du Dieu. C'est une parole qui est proposée ou exposée au public de telle sorte qu'elle doit faire par elle-même la preuve de ce qu'elle annonce ou énonce. En particulier, elle doit faire la preuve de ce qu'elle dit, de ce qu'elle montre, de ce qu'elle institue concernant le destin de la vie humaine et observable, recevable par soi-même. Pour cela, je pense que si on remonte à cette origine commune, à ce geste de séparation, geste de séparation que je crois vraiment commun à la tragédie entre Eschyle et Euripide et à la philosophie entre les présocratiques et Platon, si on remonte à ce geste, on voit que
La religion, finalement, c'est trois choses. Ce que j'appelle ici religion, c'est trois choses. Ce sont des notions, certainement déjà, comme le salut, le destin, l'éternité, l'infini, la vie après la mort, etc. L'âme, le corps, c'est cela. Ce sont des récits, le deuxième point, les grandes fables de la mythologie et ensuite les grands récits des monothéismes. Et puis ce sont des cérémonies. La religion, c'est toujours des notions, des récits et des rites, quelle que soit la religion. Et on pourrait dire ceci, la philosophie, c'est ce qui se sépare de la religion, principalement du côté des notions. C'est ce qui va tenter de donner aux notions un statut autonome, qui va les détacher du récit, de la cérémonie et de la transcendance. Bon, la philosophie, c'est une laïcisation ou une profanation des notions. Je pense que le théâtre, c'est ce qui va tenter de se détacher de la religion du côté de la cérémonie, de l'autre côté. C'est-à-dire que le théâtre, c'est ce qui va proposer une cérémonie non religieuse. Et même, petit à petit, une cérémonie athée, une cérémonie entièrement détachée de la religion. Et puis entre les deux, nous avons le récit. Le récit, il appartient aux deux. Parce qu'il y a des récits philosophiques. Nous parlions de Nietzsche. Nietzsche, c'est rempli d'histoires philosophiques, mais Platon aussi. Platon, c'est également rempli de mythes, rempli d'histoires. Donc il y a des récits philosophiques. Et naturellement, il y a des récits au théâtre. Des intrigues, des fables, des personnages. Et donc, la vraie scène de confrontation entre le théâtre et la philosophie, c'est cet ensemble, les notions, les récits, les cérémonies, étant entendu que, finalement, le théâtre tire du côté de la cérémonie, la philosophie tire du côté des notions, le récit est plus ou moins partagé, ce qui explique qu'il y ait conflit et aussi complicité, les deux. Il y a conflit parce que, malgré tout, le philosophe va toujours dire que la cérémonie n'est pas la pureté de la notion. La cérémonie, c'est la notion, mais c'est la notion représentée, c'est la notion figurée, c'est la notion symbolisée. Ce sont toutes les grandes cérémonies religieuses. Toute grande cérémonie religieuse, c'est toujours la présentation d'une notion ou d'un dieu dans une figure. Et ce côté figuratif, le philosophe va le reprocher au théâtre comme étant une sorte de déchéance de la notion. Il va exiger la notion pure. Puis le théâtre, lui, de son côté, va soutenir que la cérémonie, ce que j'appelle la cérémonie, qui est le jeu, la présentation, qui est tout ce que vous voulez, et la séparation avec la vie ordinaire, le théâtre va dire que ce n'est que là que la notion s'empare des corps et des voix pour présenter une figure du destin et du sens de l'existence. Et que la notion reste au fond impénétrable, abstraite, tant qu'elle n'a pas traversé les corps. Bien qu'on dirait que le théâtre, c'est l'idée de la notion encore en voix, c'est-à-dire finalement présentée dans une cérémonie symbolique, tandis que la philosophie, c'est la tentative de rattacher la notion à un principe. Comme le dit Platon, pour comprendre une notion, il faut que je la comprenne jusqu'à ce que j'ai
épuiser son principe.
Alors voilà, ce serait ça, au fond, la cérémonie théâtrale, c'est quand c'est l'idée que quelque chose de la notion peut être présenté, présenté encore, et partagé en public. La conviction théâtrale, c'est que on ne peut partager l'idée, partager la notion, que lorsqu'elle est présentée ou figurée dans des espaces, dans des corps, dans des voix. En ce sens, le théâtre, on pourrait dire, c'est la cérémonie du caractère profane et public de la vérité. Et l'idée que le théâtre, c'est cela. La vérité du destin des hommes est présentée et partagée au théâtre. Mais la philosophie objectera toujours, tout en étant fascinée par cela, qu'elle peut ouvrir, elle, un accès à la vérité dans une forme qui économise la médiation de la figure. Et donc c'est une querelle entre la figure et l'infigurable. Cette querelle entre le théâtre et la philosophie, entre la figure et l'infigurable. Et la philosophie aura tendance à dire que toute figuration est en réalité une défiguration. Que le théâtre défigure la vérité parce qu'il veut la figurer. Cependant que le théâtre soutiendra que sans figure, l'idée dépérit, l'idée s'absente de toute présence. Alors, comment conclure ? Comment conclure ? Et là, il me semble que c'est dans les tentatives extrêmes des deux bords que l'on voit le mieux à la fois la contradiction et peut-être sa solution, en tout cas son apaisement. Alors, qu'est-ce que j'appelle les tentatives extrêmes ? Du côté de la philosophie, la tentative la plus extrême, c'est une tentative qui reviendrait à formaliser l'idée sans jamais la figurer. Ce serait une tentative de formalisation intégrale du sens ou de l'intelligible, éliminant toute figuration. C'est l'idée d'une pure mathématique de la vérité. Et c'est en un certain sens l'architecture de Spinoza. L'éthique de Spinoza comme machinerie antithéâtrale. Puis, à l'autre bord, on aurait un théâtre qui, au contraire, tirerait du côté de l'absoluité du corps, c'est-à-dire du côté de la présence absolue. Peut-être le théâtre de la cruauté, partout. Et d'autres tentatives de ce genre, qui font du corps lui-même le centre de la théâtralité absolue. Et au fond, si on examine ces tentatives extrêmes, on s'aperçoit que l'une comme l'autre abandonne l'idée de la figuration. Évidemment clair du côté de la formalisation pure, de l'idéal de la formalisation pure.
Il n'y a aucune figure, il n'y a plus que des lettres. Mais du côté du théâtre de la présence corporelle pure, ce n'est plus non plus une figure, c'est une présence comme telle. Et la présence comme telle ne figure rien, elle est à elle-même sa propre donation, sa propre expression. Donc au fond, la philosophie la plus formelle et le théâtre le plus cruel, par exemple partout, le théâtre du corps montré, exhibé, de l'héroïsme et de du supplice du corps, ces deux extrémités qui paraissent porter l'opposition à son comble, disent en un certain sens la même chose, à savoir que la vérité est sans figure. La vérité n'a pas de figure. Au fond, l'idée que la vérité a une figure est encore une idée qui remonte à un rapport archaïque à la vérité. Que la modernité, ou dans son accomplissement, c'est précisément la destitution de toute figure. Alors, la destitution de toute figure, elle a deux orientations. Une, que je dirais hyper philosophique, mathématique formelle de l'idée, et une autre que je dirais hyper théâtrale. Et si on est dans cette liaison entre hyper théâtralité et hyper philosophie, on retrouve la complicité à l'origine du théâtre et de la philosophie. Leur naissance commune, qui finalement était non seulement d'arracher la vérité au Dieu, mais d'arracher la vérité à la figure, c'est-à-dire à la représentation. Et ça, cet arrachement de la vérité à la représentation, la traverse toute l'histoire de la philosophie et toute l'histoire du théâtre. Et en ce sens, nous pouvons dire, s'il y a des querelles et s'il y a des amours, c'est parce que c'est la même histoire. Comme en amour, c'est la même histoire, mais justement, c'est là qu'est le problème. Merci.
Circulate this widely it's possible, and I'm sure it will. Emily, after asking you to give a short response to the lecture drawing on Rhapsodia, I didn't see the lecture beforehand, so I'll make some more general points about the relation between Alain Badiou's thought and the theater. And I'm happy to say that some of the things I wanted to foreground actually were made quite explicit in the lecture, so I beg your pardon if some of the points seem maybe less surprising than they might have. What I want to talk briefly, just for about 10 minutes or so, about is a feature of Alain Badiou's thought that's particularly fascinating for me, and that is this double relation to the theater on the one hand and to Plato on the other. So first let me remind you, and after today's lecture and Emily's introduction, perhaps that reminder is understood, just how central the theater is for Alain Badiou's thought. There are the wonderful texts about the theater, from the essays on Beckett, his writings on Mallarmé in Entre les Démons, his remarks on Brecht in Le Siècle, as well as pieces on other dramatists and directors, and of course, last but not least, L'Absodie pour le théâtre itself. Second, there are his own plays, especially the Ahmed cycle, about which I believe maybe Bruno will talk and Emily talk also. So I don't want to say much about them, except to note that in being a playwright as well as a philosopher, Alain Badiou joins a long and interestingly enough primarily French tradition of playwriting philosophers that include Voltaire and Rousseau, as well as Sartre and Camus, among others. Why that is a particularly French tradition, I don't know. Maybe we can talk about that. And finally, there's the fact that the formulation of Alain Badiou's philosophy itself resonates richly with theatrical terms and concepts, both in his theory of the subject as a particular kind of agent, and of course, in his notion of the event, which also serves as the foundational concept for the liveness of the theater. Together, these elements make for a theatrical or dramatic, the American philosopher Kenneth Burke would say, dramatistic philosophy. And from this perspective, one might relate Badiou to a tradition of philosophy that incorporates drama and theater into its inner processes, a tradition that extends from Kierkegaard and Nietzsche to the Deleuze of Différence et Répétition. All right, so much for the relation to the theater, the text about the theater, Badiou's own drama, and the formulation of a theatrical or dramatistic philosophy. But then, and that's the fascinating move for me, Alain Badiou also uses Plato as one of the most important reference points for his philosophy, indeed for the project of philosophy as such. And this is, on the face of it, a surprising move, since Plato, after all, is readily associated with an attack on the theater. We just heard a little bit about that also. Something that is, in the English-speaking world, called an anti-theatrical prejudice. And this term prejudice, of course, points to a moral register. Apparently, there's something wrong with Plato's attack on the theater. And this unfortunate prejudice, as the story is often told, mostly on the part of theater studies that wants to protect the theater from its supposed enemy, Plato, led to a more general anti-theatrical tendency in philosophy for which philosophy has tended to oppose essence to appearance, and so on and so forth. Indeed, it is because of this logic that so many of the philosophers that I just mentioned as part of this theatrical tradition of philosophy, including and especially Nietzsche and Deleuze, are self-declared anti-Platonists. And this makes a lot of sense. We accept the story of Plato's anti-theatrical prejudice. The best way of overturning the notoriously anti-theatrical Plato is by means of a theatrical philosophy. Okay, so So now the point I'm driving at is that Alain Badiou, even though he continues in some sense this dramatic and theatrical tradition of philosophy, is precisely not an anti-Platonist. Against the anti-Platonist consensus of much of today's thought, he has insisted over and over again on Plato as a central figure for philosophy. And this, I think, has profound implications for the relation between theater and philosophy. It leads, and this again we've just heard, it leads in part to a new view of Plato himself. In particular, it recognizes that the standard story of the bad, morally subject, anti-theatrical prejudice of Plato is false. Not only was Plato himself a philosophical dramatist, he can also be seen as the origin of an entire tradition of drama. One could call it a critical drama, or even an anti-theatrical drama, with the proviso that now anti-theatricality or anti-theatricalism is seen as a productive form of critique, not as a prejudice that has to be overcome. The cover I chose for this issue of theater survey speaks directly to this other Plato. It seems, you can't really see it, but it seems ordinary enough. It's a scene, a typical scene, if you will, of a production of an off-way theater in 21st century New York. Except that there's nothing ordinary about it in that sense, for it comes from a recent production by the Target Margin Theater, an off Broadway theater company, of Plato's Symposium, a staging of Plato's Symposium, a proof precisely of this dramatic legacy of Plato. And this legacy, one could then say, reaches its climax with modernism and points us precisely to Alain Badiou's favorite dramatists, including Mallarmé, Beckett, and Brecht, because all three of them install something of Plato's radical critique at the center of their drama. So I think, among other things, Alain Badiou helps us recover this tradition of drama that goes back to Plato, and whose most important feature is a ambiguous and critical relation to theatricality. So my thesis is this, that it is precisely this double relation to Plato on the one hand and the theatrical tradition on the other that provides this philosophy with its critical force. And on the one hand, this critical force is directed at the theater and theater studies as it is currently practiced. In Logique des Mondes, Alain Badiou summarizes what he calls democratic materialism as the belief that there are only bodies and languages. This belief, this democratic materialism, I think is particularly dominant in theater studies and the study of performance, where the doctrine that the theater is exclusively an art of the body has served as an unexamined assumption of much theater practice and theory. And it is therefore with respect to theater studies that I find Alain Badiou's supplement to democratic materialism particularly important, namely that there are only bodies and languages, except that they are truth, sinon qu'il y a de vérité. This supplement, for example, leads to the claim in Rhapsodie pour le théâtre and also today that theater is a theater of ideas, that all theater really is a theater of idea. This is, in today's exclusive focus on the body and the language of the theater, a provocative claim. Now, it's clear that this claim that theater is a theater of ideas does not mean that the theater should explain ideas in an expository manner, but rather that theater is touched by the recognition that languages and bodies must not be taken for granted. And this is precisely, I think, the view of theater that goes back to Plato. And it, because of that critique, what is potentially a very profound critique of today's theater studies, is for me was for me the most important reason to publish Rhapsodie pour le théâtre in the main theater studies journal, where I believe it will have a transformative effect. So on the one hand, Plato is a generative critical principle that stands for a large-scale critique, if not dismissal, of theater and theater study. And on the other hand, Alain Badiou adapts Plato for his critique of philosophy as it is currently practiced, particularly the philosophy of democratic materialism. Once more, it's important to say that Alain Badiou is not calling for a new idealism, certainly not as it is usually understood. The Plato here is not the Plato primarily of the theory of forms, but perhaps one could say the Plato of the target margin theater, namely the dramatic Plato. Badiou calls his own approach dialectical materialism, as opposed to the democratic materialism of languages and bodies. In the context of today's lecture on theater and philosophy, and the, to my mind, central importance of Plato for my reading of Badiou's work, I wonder whether we can translate or relate dialectical materialism to this dramatic Plato. So can dialectical, this is my question, can dialectical materialism be understood as a particular form of Platonism, a dramatic Platonism, if we understand dramatic to stand for the particular status of materiality in the theater? This is my question.
Bodies and non-wages, we can express everything. And in fact, the objection of Plato is that there is something which is of importance and which cannot be presented in the form of strict agency of bodies and non-wages. And so we can interpret the critique of the theater by Plato of exactly as you do as a critic of the theater of democratic materialism, finally. Democratic materialism in theater itself. That is the critique of a particular aesthetic of theater, something like that, and not of theater generally speaking. And so the idea of the dramatic Plato, which would be something else than the classical idealist Plato, is a distinction between appearance and essence and so on, is for me absolutely the right way concerning all these contributions. And maybe the question is why, but you know this question better than me, finally. Why there is today a so big pressure in the direction of the theater which is reduced to the experience of body or something like that? And the suspicion, for example, concerning text, suspicion concerning old forms of narrative and so on. And my answer is that in one sense I understand all that in the direction of theater without theater, something like that. A theater without any form of representation. At the end, we have the idea of a theater which is invisible, like somebody walk in the street and he only knows himself that he's walking in the street and it's a representation for itself, but for everybody he's walking in the street. And it's naturally all limits are interesting in themselves. So something like that, which exists, walk in the street and it is theater. It is theater without any form of theater which separate theater from ordinary life. So, but precisely, Plato said, if Plato sees something like that, which is, would be horrible for but if Plato said, but it's not at all the kind of representation. It's the purest form of representation. It's the point where you are walking in the street without any reason to walk in the street, except to represent somebody who walks in the street. And so you pretend you are outside the representation, but you are absolutely inside the purest form. You are in the very essence of imitation. Because your imitation is not visible as an imitation, and so it's the most abstract imitation. And to finish with all that, I understand that sort of pressure concerning the theater of the body and the theater practically indiscernible of the ordinary life has an attempt to escape the notation, but which finally exhibits the purest form of representation. And I think the way of Brecht, for example, which is to exhibit the representation as to show the representation inside the representation is, in one sense, much more radical than a sort of indiscernibility between representation and pure presentation. Because this is that. The fact that you present your body without any signal of representation. Where the point of presentation and representation is the same, you have not presentation, but the purest form of representation. The presentation of representation as such, something like that. And so Plato is useful for that by saying that finally we must abandon the idea of the pure antagonistic form between presentation and representation and much more to explain that the history of theater is by necessity the history of the separation from volition. And it's not exactly the separation between the presentation and the volition, but more the separation between figure and figuration and non-figuration. It's not exactly it would be philosophically complex, but I agree completely with your reading, and it explains why today there are so many representations of Petrov. Because it's a paradoxical conclusion that finally to find something new in theater it's a good exercise to play Plato. And it's the most interesting thing would be if Plato himself could see all that as the destiny of his work. Finally, on the theatre.
I'm going to make some comments on Badiou's own philosophy as theatre. Officially, at least, Alain Badiou is no fan of round tables. Certainly no more so than his master, Louis Althusser. I remember how Althusser made fun of the idea of round tables in his course of philosophy for scientists. He says that it is necessarily comforting an ideology of interdisciplinarity, which he summarizes as follows, and this is a quote, "When one ignores something that the whole world ignores, it suffices to bring together all the ignorance. Science will emerge from the gathering of the ignorance." And yet here we are once again in New York City for a roundtable that in some aspects would seem to have all the appearances of interdisciplinary, since we are supposed to discuss the topic of philosophy and theater, whose relations, including repeated calls for some kind of disciplinary action, have been strained in one direction or the other since at least Plato. We all know, and we've talked about it, that Plato saw in theater the threat of a diversion of truth into a mere simulacrum. In this regard, more interestingly, Plato's position was not unlike that of the Catholic Church, whose tense and contradictory relation to theater, to actors, and to visual pomp of all kinds, despite the profound theatricality of its own central act, that is the Mass, is a topic that Badiou discusses at length in Rhapsody for the Theater, moved in this direction above all by another of his masters, the Mallarmé of Igitur and Divagation. He discusses, Badiou discusses, following in Mallarmé's lead, the sort of fascination and repulsion between the Catholic Church and the Mass itself as a theatrical act. Against Plato's ban, philosophy also has had an inverse reaction, which sought to put philosophy itself on stage. Badiou's first master, Jean-Paul Sartre, excelled in this attempt, and Laissez question d'Altonat, for example, is one of his favorite references. In his philosophical work, at the price, it is true, of subordinating the force of theatrical affirmation to a form of philosophy watered down to a moral didacticism. Some of Badiou's work as a playwright, particularly in Red Scarf, Les Chapeaux Rouges, published in 1979, and first performed as a full-fledged opera in 1884, and Ahmed Philosophe, may seem to go in the same direction of what we might call didactic philosophical theater. However, the power of political affirmation in the first case of Red Scarf and of farcical poeticization in the second keep these works from veering off in the direction of the sort of didactic illustration of concepts that are available outside of theater. Even when, as in the case of Ahmed Philosophe, the titles of these pieces, these 34 pieces or sainetes, may well appear to be excerpted from Badiou's magnum opus being an event. There are sort of pieces, small pieces on the nothing, the event, poetry, the subject, truth, mathematics, nature, the origin, the contradiction. But Badiou is not interested in staging his philosophical ideas. In the materiality of the theatrical performance, and especially through the force of comedy, all four plays in the Ahmed cycle are farces, and Badiou's only tragedy, L'Incident d'Antioche, remains unpublished. He seeks to produce what he calls theater ideas, which are strictly immanent forms of thought and not just didactic illustrations of concepts that are available elsewhere. The relation between philosophy and theater that I want to discuss today, however, is of an entirely different kind. And it is perhaps not unrelated to the format of the round table, of the public debate, or even the public lecture. At least when it is free and open to the public as it is today, as opposed to most of these events involving Badiou, say in the UK, where there's a steep price to be paid. I mean the extent to which Badiou's own philosophy bears the traces of being theatrical in its own right. So it's not a question of philosophy against theater, as in Plato, or of the theater of philosophy, as in Sartre, but of philosophy itself as theatrical. Most of you know that theater as a singular art form, belongs to one of the four conditions of truth, together with science, politics, and love, that condition philosophy from the outside, since philosophy for Badiou cannot produce truth of its own. In other words, a theater performance can be an event whose truth philosophy can help discern and elucidate without itself being able to acquire the force of an event. Even though these two activities, writing for the theater and producing works of philosophy, often do occur in one and the same person, for Badiou there is a strict division without hierarchy between theater and philosophy, which corresponds to the split between the condition and the conditioned. Such a relation of philosophy to the condition of theater today, including its alleged crisis, underlies Rhapsody for the Theater, which bears the subtitle, as Emily pointed out, A Short Philosophical Treatise. Very early on, however, starting in Thesis 7 and 15, with the introduction of a generic you will object that, and then explicitly beginning in Thesis 19, with the hilarious dialogue between the empiricist and me, that is, Badiou, a dialogue that will continue throughout, this treatise seems to take on a theatrical form of its own. It's not difficult, or no great leap of imagination is required, to allow portions of this text, Rhapsody for the Theater, to pass over into something along the lines of Les Citrouilles, the last of Badiou's Ahmed plays, in which, in the contemporary rewriting of Aristophanes' The Frogs, he has his main character descend into hell and argue it out with an unforgiving chorus over who is the greatest playwright of the 20th century, Bertolt Brecht or Paul Claudel, in terms of what each of them might contribute to an overcoming of the crisis of theater today. I mean, long sections of Rhapsody for the Theater could be slid into this play. But the relation between Badiou's philosophy and theater that I have in mind is even more imminent than this. I am referring to the point where philosophy itself seems unable to guarantee its transmission without in some way becoming theatrical. Here I'm thinking of a strange and hermetic little text, which is called What is a Philosophical Institution?, which is translated into English as a kind of programmatic text to a collection of critical essays called The Praxis of Alain Badiou that was published in Australia. And here, Badiou discusses the nature of a philosophical institution, such as the Collège International de Philosophie, in terms of its address, its transmission, and its inscription. These last two aspects, in particular, seem almost naturally to invite a form of theatrical staging. Without them, philosophy could be reduced to the solitary affirmation of the sameness of being and thinking, whose empty address does not require any public. And I quote, "No statement of philosophy is addressed as such to anyone, if it is reduced to the bare affirmation that being and thinking are ultimately the same." But a philosophy, a particular philosophy, in its historical development, requires a transmission and the inscription of a few marks whereby philosophy proposes itself first to some ones and then to all. This is another quote. "Unlike the address, which is void and doesn't need any public, and transmission, which is proposed to some ones, inscription is open and offered to all." So in addition to the role of the institution of disciples and of the frequently invisible and clandestine activities of transmission, translation, and publication, I wonder whether there is not also a degree of theatricality that is constitutive of philosophy as soon as it leaves the solitary space of its hut or its log cabin, where it pretends to be confined from Descartes to Heidegger. I mean, that sort of the affirmation of being the identity of being and thinking, you know, has always been presented in the fable of the philosopher who's just doing the thinking in his hut. But as soon as it needs to be transmitted, as it is today, or in a round table, it acquires a theatrical form. I mean, if we consider the seven elements or parts of the theater which Badiou enumerates in Rhapsody for the Theater, do we not find all of them reunited on an occasion such as ours, including the role of an actor addressing a crowd, the presence of a stage director, Emily after today, or Josefina Yersa yesterday and tonight, albeit one whose stage direction in this case, I should add, are minimal, to the point of leaving open the language of the performance. A stage setting, La Maison Française, or some art gallery such as Miguel Abreu or the Tilton Gallery, a decor often reduced to simple table with chairs, costumes, formal or informal, dressed up in angelical all white or intellectual all black, at least one spectator, in this case very often a full house, And finally, a textual referent, in this case, a mixture of the translation of Rhapsody for the Theater and the actor's personal notes, which we all have. So all seven elements of the theater would appear to be present even when the genre is that of a round table. But the same could no doubt be said about your seminar in Paris, which takes place in a space in Redoutum that for all intents and purposes is indistinguishable from the theater hall. So is this convergence of philosophy and theater innocent, or just anecdotal? Does all philosophy, beyond its empty Permian premise about the identity of thinking and being, require a public, a stage, some dialogue, and so on? Or are there also risks involved, as Plato reminds us? And I should add that such warnings are not limited to the philosopher. Even within the condition of art, there have been similar pronouncements made, for example, the classical warning against the theatricality of art, particularly painting, proffered by Michael Friedman in the late 60s. And I quote, "Success, even the survival of the art, has come increasingly to depend on their ability to defeat theater." To allow theater to invade the other arts, according to this statement, would be as disastrous as the entry of theatrical simulacra in Plato's Republic. Another quote, "The concepts of quality and value, and to the extent that these are central to art, the concept of art itself, are meaningful or wholly meaningful only within the individual arts. What lies between the arts is theater." This is still Michael Friedman. But you, for his part, would much more readily identify this threat of the mixed or the in-between with cinema and not with theater. This is a quote from Handbook of Anesthetics. "In theater, it is explicitly, almost physically, a question of the encounter of an idea, while in cinema, it is a question of the passage of the idea, perhaps even of its phantom or its symbol." And he has long diatribes in Rhapsody for the Theater against cinema. The cinema hall, for example, not being a public space, a movie audience being completely separate from a theater public. There is no spectator, but it says in a projection room. And yet, it is no secret that beyond its theatrical impulses that can be detected already in the philosophical treatise that is Rhapsody for the Theater, but you has been toying rather seriously, I should add, with the idea of making a film out of Plato's life and the Republic, with Brad Pitt, ideally in the role of Socrates, and Leonardo DiCaprio as Alcibiades, if not making a movie out of being an event itself. So where does this tendency come from? I would like to say that it corresponds to an anti-philosophical strain in Badiou's thinking. That is both what makes it so appealing to many people and what risks reducing it to a mere act in the theatrical sense of the term. It is perhaps no coincidence that Badiou's parallel, though I hear I'm no longer part of the in-crowd of the New York City, rarely his co-actor in these small theatrical performances that take place every year in New York City around the month of November, it is the greatest and most exhilarating anti-philosopher of our times who shows up, namely Slavoj Žižek. Here, much more so than in Badiou's sober and slightly subdued performances, as you saw tonight, the transmission of ideas is inseparable from a certain histrionics, that is, a material, deeply physical, and bodily performance. My God, how should I put this? In which the subject of the enunciation relentlessly and effervescently must make himself appear on stage within his own statements and now also available on DVD, Žižek, with exclamation mark. Remember also Pasolini's project to bring Paul's life up to date with the contemporary moment. Athens would be modern Paris, ancient Rome would be New York City, and Jerusalem would be contemporary Rome. In the move from Paris to New York City, in other words, philosophers would expose themselves to the risk of turning into sophists for sale, or into anti-philosophers. This reminds me somewhat guiltily of an anecdote from Badiou's first visit to the States, at least for a one-man show. He was here in the Chicago conference, but not as a main act. When we were walking through the streets of the Upper West Side, we were trying to remember when it was, December 2000, and Alain almost got hit by a truck on Amsterdam Avenue. "Death of a Philosopher," he said, could be a good title for the movie that we were talking about. And there would have been illustrious antecedents, such as Roland Barthes, who died, really, in this case, in similarly unfortunate circumstances. My fundamental question then is whether the philosophers act on the stage of the international lecture circuit, for which New York City started to serve as a trampoline half a dozen years ago, does not risk turning into the radical act of an anti-philosopher, whose form, think of Nietzsche's madness, but also of Lacan's performances for radio and television, will always be more or less theatrical, insofar as theater, as Mallarmé was keenly aware, stands as the model of the genuine act as such. To put it differently, I wonder whether philosophy, when it surreptitiously turns into a theatrical performance in front of a live audience, does not dream of becoming an event or a happening in its own right, which is something that, technically speaking, it should try to avoid at all costs, unless it falls prey to a disastrous prescription. But this is precisely what theater promises, since, as Badiou writes in Rhapsody for the Theater, and I quote, "No other art form is able to pin down the intensity of what happens the way theater does." To extract the idea of the event from events such as those of art or politics, in other words, perhaps it is inevitable or even necessary that philosophy become fused, at least briefly, just the time of a flash, the temps d'un éclair, with the profitable yet also profoundly anti-philosophical madness of the theater, or to use Mallarmé's words, which ends Rhapsody, and I quote, "necessary, the extracted idea, profitable madness." There, one of the acts of the universe was just committed. Nothing else. The breath remained, the end of word and gesture united. Blow out the candle of being by which all has been proved. Thank you.
Impure. We cannot define what is the language of philosophy. It's not like poetry, mathematics, novel, and so on. What is the language of philosophy? Sometimes theater, in fact, certainly. Sometimes pure formalization. Sometimes something like predication, something like address to everybody, sometimes arguments, and so on. So, for the very beginning, we find in the language of philosophy practically all possible forms, fragments, treaties, and so on. Stories, narrative, theater. And we have two limits for this expansion of all languages, all possible languages. On one side, strict formalization, so mathematics, and on the other side, strict infinity, affirmative infinity of language, that is poetry. And so we can see that the language of philosophy is always somewhere between mathematics and poetry. If you have Nietzsche, it's near poetry. If you have Spinoza, near mathematics. But we have between the two. And what Bruno is saying is, on one side of all that, on the side of the effect of philosophy, or the supposed existence of a philosophical act. Supposed existence of the philosophical act.
But it's in my opinion, it's a problematic existence. Because we cannot say that there exists a philosophical art only because we have to organize transmission. There is a difference between transmission, maybe sometimes a transmission in the form of a public theater, and the existence of a philosophical act. Because the existence of a philosophical act determines some particular philosophy, and not philosophy in general. Certainly, for some philosophers that I name anti-philosophers, there exists something like a philosophical art. And very often, that sort of philosopher is very near religion. That is the case in Kierkegaard, that is the case in Pascal, that is the case sometimes in Rousseau, and so on. When we have the idea that there exists something like a philosophical art, we have generally the idea that philosophy is in close relationship with purely religious conviction or abstract religious conviction. It's something like a conviction, a pure faith, if you want. And the act is the act of this faith. But when it's not the case, we have all forms of languages, but not by necessity, the relationship to an act. And so the difference between event, act, and so on is maintained. It's my first remark. My second remark is that it's difficult to say that I am particularly, that my philosophy as such is in close relationship to the idea of histrionism. In fact, the best theater, the best moment of theater was your imitation. And so it's a demonstration that to be in theater, certainly you have to speak to the public, but there is something else. And this something else was, was the creation of something which exists, something a new form of imitation. So when you were transforming yourself in Slavoj Žižek, it was certainly a theater. But to return to the problem, I think that the probably the most important distinction from the very beginning is the distinction between, first, the multiplicity of languages of philosophy and its two limits, mathematics and poetry, and second, the distinction between philosophy as something spoken and philosophy as something written. And it's another impurity. Philosophy is, the existence of philosophy is not purely written, and is not purely spoken, but it's always the same thing. We have the two. Finally, there is something which is not written at all in Socrates, and there is something which is purely written in some philosophers, like, for example, Descartes or Kant. They were, Kant was a professor too, but when we read Kant, we see that it's purely written. And so, finally, my conclusion is that the theatrical appearance of philosophy is the appearance of its impurity. So, impurity between spoken and written, impurity between mathematics and poetry, and so on. And philosophy is not a language. Philosophy is in language and in all forms possible of language. And so it's proper histrionism, if you want,
is a linguistic one. It's some form of thinking which goes inside so different forms of language that finally it is like an actor which is playing poetry, mathematics, and events are going. And so the pure multiplicity of languages has a form of impurity. Maybe it's something which is near theater. I accept it. But, you know, finally, in my philosophical books, there is so many things that it's an art theater.
There's a way in which you invariably revert to some sort of theatrical mode to bring to thought or bring into articulation certain moments of a kind of revolutionary idea. And I've been struck by how messy some of the scenes are. And I just wonder if you have any thoughts about this, because the theatricality, as you pointed out with Bruno, becomes more apparent at certain points in the philosophical texts or in these other forms of literary writing, whatever you want to call them. And so the question is, it is political theater. There's a political theater moment, and I wonder if you would please tell me comment to pass le moment où tu passes à la révolution, c'est comme si il y a un moment de théâtre qui s'impose, soit dans le théâtre lui-même comme genre, dans les écrits théâtraux, soit dans les textes plutôt comme absolus qui est un traité.
Yes, I think the relationship, the philosophical relationship between theater and politics, revolution is a very, for me, a very obscure question. It's clear that it is a question, because there is a close relationship in my world between theater and revolution, theater and politics, and so on. And it's also, naturally, a close relationship between philosophical concepts and political determination. But if we take the three terms, politics, philosophy, and theater, it's a very complex field. When I write plays, it's impossible for me to write anything else. So there is, it's for me a separate language. When I begin to write a play, it's a new subjectivity, something else. I am in the theater, in fact. And my relationship to language is completely different because it's not purely written. It's written, naturally, but it's written for something else than pure writing. And so, when I am in theater properly, in writing plays, there is no relationship for me to philosophy. Philosophy is apart. Philosophy is suppressed. And it's a very good thing for me, because you know, philosophy is very annoying. When you write philosophy, you write something that you know. It's really an exercise of transmission. It's not you invent something, but generally when you write philosophy, it's really something which is an exercise of transmission, which is for others, absolutely for others, not really for yourself.
because you know all that. And so it's a completely altruist. it's an ethic determination to write philosophy. And so, as everybody knows, ethics is very annoying. And it's not a pleasure. It's not really a pleasure. It's exactly the contrary when I have theater. It's fundamentally a pleasure. It's a pleasure. And so the relationship to politics is immediate. It's a form of that sort of pleasure. And it's near the pleasure of action, the pleasure of man, the pleasure of collective determination, something like that. And you know, except in that sort of situation, there is something in philosophy which is near solitude. When you hide philosophy, there is the solitude of the concept. The creation of concepts, as Deleuze says, is something which is a creation in solitude. And the theater, immediately when you write in solitude, you are with others. And it's the same thing in politics. The politics is something with, political solitude is a nonsense. You can be outside of politics, but political solitude is a monstrosity. It's not a complete answer, but I agree with you that there is a particular relationship between theater and revolution, between the political moment and theater, and this relation is a subjective relationship of pleasure. Political pleasure is a very complex pleasure, because it's a pleasure of anxiety. Paradoxical pleasure of anxiety. I can have something like that. May 68 and after was the collective pleasure of existence, absolutely, but always with anxiety, because all was obscure. Nobody knows precisely what we are doing. Tomorrow was different from today, and so on. And so it was love, effectively, but it was love with anxiety. And so it's a pleasure of anxiety. And there is something like that in theater too. Because a theater also is something which is immediate, which begins and finishes, and tomorrow is not the same as today. It's a very strange experience. Why one day it's good and the day after it's not good? It's a failure. Very important. And so we can say something like that, to recapitulate. Philosophy is the connection of all that, but it's the solitude of concepts. And politics and theater are in relationship by the mediation of this form of subjectivity, which is a mixture of pleasure and anxiety.
First, let me thank you for your the most interesting talk by not just a French philosopher, but any philosopher I've heard for many, many years. It was a great pleasure listening to you. But I must ask you about the first thing that most theater audiences come into contact with, which often attracts them to the play or to the author, and that is the title of the play, or the name, the label that the author, the writer, gives to the kind of work he's doing. Now, you've chosen the label is dialectical materialism. Now, in your country and in my country, this is not a label, a title, which is going to attract many readers or theater goers. It's either going to confuse them, no, that certainly, but insofar as they understand it at all, it's most likely going to antagonize them. Now, I think it's a wonderful label, but I want to know why you chose this label to talk about your writings on theater. You explained a little bit about the materialist dimension in discussing the philosophers you ran through, but said very little, except for your frequent use of the word contradiction, you said very little about its dialectical character. So why dialectical materialism as the label for this work and perhaps other works that you've done?
I take the word dialectical or dialectics in the beginning of the logic of the world, and more generally when I speak of that today, in the general sense, which is not exactly the classical Hegelian or Marxist sense. Not on contradiction with the Hegelian or Marxist sense, but not exactly the same. Because it's a dialectics in dialectical materialism signifies fundamentally that there is something which is a third term, which is a third term in exception of the two first. So it's not the dialectical result of the two first terms, but something which is inside the two first terms, like a possible exception concerning their hegemony. So dialectical at the beginning is only something like we cannot think in the materialist field with only two terms, but it's a necessity to have three. So it's a very elementary definition of dialectics, which returns to the classical definition, one term, second term, and third. But the third term is not the result of the process of the two, it's something like an immanent exception to the world which is regulated by the two first. And naturally, different names for that in my philosophy. The most elementary name is truth, so not only bodies and languages, but also truth, but another name is event. Not only the world, the things, and the laws of the things, but also an event, and so on. And I think that in the contemporary theater, the discussion with your intervention, in the contemporary theater, we have something like that because the idea is that all the theater can be made with bodies and languages, or maybe bodies alone. Bodies are their proper languages, or expressive bodies, something like that. And I say that the dialectical point of view concerning this vision is that theater cannot really assume this restriction, and that there is always in the theater act something which is an exception to the reducibility of the representation to bodies and languages. And so there is always something which is immanent exception to what we see on the stage. And the theatrical effect is never reducible to what you see on the stage. You see, naturally, bodies, languages, and so on, but the real theatrical effect is always something which is an immanent exception to this determination, this public determination. It is the relationship between theater and philosophy at this very elementary level.
Yes. I
don't
ask
that.
But j'ai toujours appris que le théâtre, c'est la vie transposée sur la scène. C'est ça. Et les philosophes aussi veulent transmettre un message, une façon de vivre aussi. Et alors, comme j'ai toujours travaillé des classiques, on a dit que Racine peignait les hommes tels qu'ils étaient, et Corneille tel qu'il devrait être. Et alors, j'ai compris que et je sais, on dit aussi que le théâtre, c'est une école. C'est une école qu'on peut faire apprendre du théâtre. You can learn many things from the theater. Because when you play something, you transmit something. You transmit your view and many things to the people. And from the philosopher, you learn many things too. But I don't see why you're fighting. That also is a contradiction in itself. That's why. Mm-hmm. When you want to say something, you write it here. And I was so glad to be here. Okay, good night.
It's the hand of the play.
When you want to say something, you read it here.
Thank you so much.
You write something. Thank you so much. Bye.
I wanted to ask if one can speak of a theater of formalization or a tragedy even of formalization. It would seem that with the particularly Macron with the status of the letter as a kind of material support for the void or for non-being, and this imperative that one identify with the void or with castration or with non-being, that would seem to be very close to the ideal of tragedy, that there is a kind of tragic formalization or some place where the theater of the signifier or formalization comes very close to the problem of tragedy.
Yes, another very interesting question, which is present in Rhapsody, which is finally, what is the difference between comedy and tragedy inside all the history of theater? And certainly we can say that comedy is on the side of figuration and the tragedy on the side of formalization. I agree with you. There is something much more alive in the vision of human destiny in tragedy. And so it's a large way, in fact, the tragedy of the letter, I agree with you. And it is why in tragedy there is always a moment where somebody says one word and the tragedy is here. Very often we get to say yes or no. At a moment is the complete realization of the tragedy. And in comedy it's always the moment of an act. Very different. And so I agree that the disposition between the letter and the heart, thing like that, is also the distinction between tragedy and comedy, and in a way it's two completely different languages. Because the first, the formal language, the language of ceremony, and the second, the popular language, the language of the phallus. So it's the opposition is the opposition of the letter.
My question relates to what you were sort of talking around in the, at the end of your discussion, which is something that I've always thought to be one of the central problems in studying the theater, which is, you know, where is it located? There's the text and then there's the event. And I was interested in the fact that it didn't really come up and it wasn't central to your discussion until the very end, but how can we really ascribe the you know, political and maybe ethical eventness of the theater to something like Plato's dialogues if they were never, if they were not written to be performed? Or, you know, is there the same kind of maybe desire for the event that we find in plays that were just written?
think the relationship between the text as such, which is written, and the theater is always the same, even when the text has not been written for the stage. Because finally, the theater is always something like a complement of the text. The all texts for the theater are incomplete. And it's the fundamental point of the, and you can say practically concerning every text, it is incomplete. To find that sort of incompletion, if you want, is the work of the theater itself. And to create the incompletion of the text and to create the complete text on the stage. And it is why we can play with practically all texts. Naturally, there is some text which are performed or formatted for to play. But we can play certainly, for example, being an event, a good theatrical text.
Thanks for the lecture, this discussion. A friend of mine who wasn't here wished for me to ask you an open-ended question about politician Obama. And as I was listening to your speech, you know, I was kind of running Obama through the various passages, the various theatricians and theoreticians, and philosophers that you were listing. And there's so many questions I had in mind. We were talking about political theater. I'm asking a question about theatrical politics. As a critic, how do you rate Obama at this stage in history?
From the point of view of the philosophy.
Of the theatrical politics.
Proposition of a new temporality with time to examine the questions, to give an answer, to propose something new. The visible theater of a new political time, which is my vision of Obama. After that, he's black, you know. it's not so important. No, it's of very symbolic importance, naturally, in regard to the history of black people, Africa, and so on. It's a very strong symbol for humanitarian search, not only for African. So, naturally. But as in our comparison with theater, the fact that he's black is not essential in his presentation. I don't see that first. I see first whiteness, proposition of a new time, and a sort of rationalism. What do you call rationalism? Opposition of rationalism. After 8 years of pure passion, affect, oppression, and so on. So there is something like the proposition of the visibility of a new peace, something peaceful. That's my description.
I think we have to end there.